I want to just start by highlighting where I practice in terms of the laboratories and the hospital, the medical center. I'm located in the Texas Medical Center, Texas Children's Hospital in Houston, and yes, we survived Ike. The medical center did remarkably well thanks to underground power lines. That was key. So we have a large children's hospital and next across the street from other adult hospitals. And we're actively engaged in infection control practice, modern infection control practice, if you will. For the past 5 years, we've deployed molecular methods to track pathogens in our own healthcare setting. The backdrop, I guess, first of all, as I did this morning, the federal government, as well as state governments, are taking a much closer look at quality of care, and they are finally tying quality of care to reimbursement much more aggressively than they have in the past. There's been talk about quality in healthcare for a long time, and as laboratorians, we're familiar with that. But the thing to keep in mind is that the governments, as well as professional societies and the citizens at large, are taking notice. And hospital-acquired infections have been an issue in medicine for a long time. But for the first time in 2008, we are seeing reimbursement tied to health hospital-acquired infections. And for the first time, payment will be denied if patients acquire certain hospital-acquired infections. Not all, but some. It is the beginning. And as I've talked with others that have been involved in this regulatory interface with government, the consensus appears to be clear, and that is that we're going to see more encroachment in this direction, not less. And this is probably not a temporary thing. And so as hospitals and healthcare institutions in both the outpatient and inpatient setting, we need to be cautious, especially in the inpatient setting. And so there's going to be an increased emphasis on pay-for-performance, a documentation on whether certain infections are present in a patient upon admission, because if that infection is documented using molecular or routine methods, then one can possibly rule out a hospital-acquired infection, whereas if there is no documentation and if there is a possibility of a hospital-acquired infection, there may be a real impact on reimbursement and the financial bottom line for hospitals, not to mention the quality of care issue, of course, with respect to patient care, most importantly. So, as you see on this slide, the ultimate goal, of course, is to increase patient safety, to reduce morbidity and mortality associated with medical errors and nosocomial infections, to reduce costs overall to the system and to the individual patients. And so I think we all share that goal, and molecular methods certainly have become important. Now, this is a microbiology session. We're going to create basically a hybrid lecture, if you will, here between molecular microbiology, routine microbiology, and infectious disease practice. So this is just another slide. It's a bit dated, but the point is the same, and that is that states are also taking a much closer look. Just in the past several years, we've seen a real trend in a larger number of states now mandating the reporting of hospital-acquired infections, and you can see these states indicated here already with bills in red and already with legislative activity as early as 2006. So this phenomenon has been sweeping across the United States. As you can see, it's not a regional issue, it's a national issue. And so once again, we have to think very carefully about what we're doing in the laboratory to help address this issue and how to improve healthcare quality. So a few generalities at the beginning. Molecular microbiology has been with us now for over a decade, well over a decade, really since the early 1990s, about 1990, if you want to look back at this, when GenProbe and other strategies in molecular diagnostics began to be applied in the clinical laboratory. We can be proud in the field of microbiology. I'm proud as a microbiologist to say that we, in many ways, we led the way in molecular diagnostics, along with the human genetics area. So we've been challenged by different issues, and they pertain to diagnosis in terms of unculturable pathogens, organisms that may be life that may cause life-threatening infections, in which we need a rapid answer, and also the inadequacy of our phenotypic methods from time to time. As most of you, I'm sure, if not all of you are, we're big believers in the ability to look at organisms by Gram stain, to be able to use a VITEC 2, for example, to perform reliable pathogen identification. But we all know that we're limited at times by phenotypic testing. Those challenges have not abated. And even with the improvement in these systems, such as moving from VITEC to VITEC 2, as we've done in our own laboratory, we still have to wrestle with the fact that some organisms may be difficult to identify with biochemical panels. So molecular methods have been used in a variety of ways. There's also the need for quantitative information, especially in the area of virology, the advent of molecular resistance testing, and the topic that I'll focus on this afternoon, which is disease outbreak investigations or molecular epidemiology in the healthcare setting. So I'm going to focus on two issues. The majority of my time will be spent on molecular epidemiology, but as I was preparing this lecture, I thought it would be best also to address at least one other application as an example of how we might be dealing with certain hospital-acquired infections. So I'm going to talk about Clostridium difficile very briefly, recognizing that we have competition. There's a C. difficile lecture going on the other side of this campus, and I have a feeling it's not molecular. And I'm going to tell you what we've done and what we hope will make a real impact nationwide by the application of real-time PCR to detect DNA in fecal specimens. And I'm going to cover this briefly in the interest of time. That's Clostridium difficile, and yes, we can culture it readily, as you know, as microbiologists. The issue is, do we really want to culture this in the clinical laboratory? Even though we can, should we? And that was basically put aside by the mid-1990s with the advent of immunoassays and the ability to detect the toxin genes indicating the presence of toxigenic C. difficile directly. And we've been actively practicing C. difficile detection without culture for quite a long time. And these are the organisms by Gram stain, large Gram-positive organisms. Well, what has become very clear in the past, just in the past few years, really in the past 3 to 4 years, is that the immunoassays are falling short. And if we're going to talk about hospital-acquired infections and strain tracking, we also need to think carefully about detection of pathogens that may cause infections that may be community-acquired, and we are certainly confronting community-acquired Clostridium difficile. So patients may be presenting with this infection, and they may certainly acquire this infection following antimicrobial treatment in a healthcare setting. As we know, this is the top cause of, at least as a defined infectious agent, of antimicrobial-associated diarrhea and colitis. The two genes have now been well characterized with the publication of the genome. They're very large genes that encode these two toxins, toxin B and toxin A, and you can see these are massive genes for bacteria, greater than 7 and 8 kb. We have designed our own user-developed real-time PCR for direct detection of C. difficile DNA, both toxin A and B genes. And I'm going to go right to the punchline. I'll be happy to discuss details later with any of you, but this is really the punchline. We were practicing stool EIAs for several years and tracking it about an 8% positivity rate. As we predicted from our validation, which included anaerobic culture of all of these specimens, enzyme immunoassays, and DNA detection of the cultured C. difficile isolates in comparison with direct immunoassay and molecular detection, we predicted that we would effectively double our detection rate, and that is, in effect, what has happened. We launched in December 2006. We were one of the first three centers in the country, academic centers at least, in the U.S., to launch this along with Northwestern and Mayo. And you can see what's basically the experience has been similar. We've been hovering on average at about a 15% positivity rate, just about what we would have predicted. And there you can see it in a slightly different format with data now extending into 2008. It's been holding steady with some blips along the way. And the point I want to make with this, with these two slides is very simple. And that is that even for established pathogens with established diagnostic tests, in this era where we are going to be challenged greater than ever before with respect to delivering for patients quality medical care we need to carefully think about the deployment of molecular methods, and in this case, for Clostridium difficile and the diagnosis of antimicrobial-associated diarrhea. It's a real issue in pediatrics as well as adult medicine, and our pediatricians are really very enthusiastic now. We have less repeat testing, more accurate diagnosis, and we have effectively completely replaced the immunoassay in our setting. And other centers are now considering the same. So that's all about pathogen detection. Now I'm going to spend the rest of the time on PCR-based DNA typing, molecular epidemiology, if you will. And I'm going to focus again on a specific pathogen, multidrug-resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosa. I'm also going to talk about some general principles regarding DNA typing. And again, I apologize if this is a little redundant for some of you that were at the smaller molecular session this morning. Pseudomonas aeruginosa, a very familiar pathogen like Clostridium difficile to us. The difference is that we are actively growing this pathogen in the laboratory today, gram-negative organism, and you can see oxidase-positive bacilli. Of course, if we do further biochemical testing, normally we can identify this organism. But there are contexts in which even identifying Pseudomonas aeruginosa is not as trivial as it seems, and we've certainly come to grips with that, as have many others in the context of cystic fibrosis. So this is our cystic fibrosis setting, and our center highlighted here in this slide, and I want to acknowledge Dr. Peter Hyatt, who's a pediatrician, pulmonologist, and director of the Cystic Fibrosis Center at Texas Children's Hospital. We've worked together in trying to address this issue of multidrug-resistant organisms in our hospital, particularly Pseudomonas aeruginosa, but also MRSA and other drug-resistant pathogens, other gram-negative bacteria. We have also formed a tripartite partnership with our infection control department, headed by Jeff Stark in our pediatric infectious disease service. We have approximately 300 pediatric patients that are seen regularly at Texas Children's. This is recognized as a center of excellence by the CF Foundation. And I guess the point I want to make, this isn't about bragging about our institution. It's that even in the best, most active centers in the country, we are faced constantly with the challenge of drug-resistant organisms and how we deploy our resources in a multidisciplinary fashion and, again, collaborating across departmental lines in our institution. Now, I had to delete some data here, but I want to just stick with the national data. And that is just to highlight the fact that Pseudomonas aeruginosa, of course, isn't the only problem in terms of respiratory tract infections and cystic fibrosis. We have a national average now 42%. This is from the CFF, Cystic Fibrosis Foundation Patient Registry, exceeding 17% for MRSA and over 3% for Burkholderia sepatia, another important gram-negative pathogen complex, that is certainly important in the context of cystic fibrosis. And again, more numbers here, basically what I just showed you to reiterate. And now let's move on to Pseudomonas aeruginosa in the context of cystic fibrosis. So we have sputum samples that are collected from patients with CF. These are children with cystic fibrosis. These isolates may be identified by a variety of approaches using different media, as you've done in that in your laboratory, and I won't bother reiterating the details of that, but just make a point here, another example of how we're using molecular methods. We do have a number of Pseudomonas aeruginosa isolates from patients with cystic fibrosis that, due to the nature of these organisms in the respiratory tract, may be difficult to identify by conventional microbiology. And so we are especially challenged with certain strains of Pseudomonas aeruginosa from these patients, and we do use DNA pyrosequencing to identify some of these isolates. So we use the VITEC-2 for biochemical identification, but we also use DNA pyrosequencing when we need it. And this is just to show you, we've published the data set in the Journal of Clinical Microbiology. We extract the DNA from pure cultures of Pseudomonas. This is, again, a partnership within our department this time between microbiology and our molecular section. We amplify these variable regions in the 16S ribosomal DNA. We do the sequencing. This is a user-friendly version of DNA sequencing. If you're not familiar with it, I'll just make it brief. And then we go ahead and do sequence analysis and pathogen identification. So there are a number of isolates that we can identify biochemically and others in which we need DNA sequencing to help us arrive at a definitive identification. And these are important points because, as you'll see, we want to be clear on this identification before we move forward with DNA typing. One needs to couple robust identification with a robust molecular practice to really make this all work when we talk about modern infection control. It's simply not enough to think about DNA typing in isolation. One can get hints in terms of species identification, in terms of typing, and using molecular methods such as DiversaLab, but it's really in the context of accurate biochemical and other molecular identification that it really then is an overall robust program. For more than 3 years, we have collected isolates, and this is just, this number is greater now, but the bottom line is, at least with PIRA sequencing, we have relied on it, on this technology for identification of a number of isolates. What do we mean when we say multi-drug Pseudomonas aeruginosa, or multi-drug resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosa, as we say MRPA instead of MRSA? These organisms are resistant to antibiotics in two or more of the three groups listed here, aminoglycosides, fluoroquinolones, and beta-lactams. And I've indicated a few prominent examples that we normally think about. There certainly are others. And the key point to remember is that these organisms tend to have a tendency towards defects and mismatch repair and are essentially hypermutable strains of Pseudomonas aeruginosa. There's been some very elegant molecular microbial research going on in this area that has documented that. And so by being able to accumulate a variety of mutations, some of these strains then become multi-drug resistant. So that's what we're dealing with. Now, we want to get beyond the species level. It's not enough to simply identify Pseudomonas aeruginosa, do the susceptibility testing, and say we've got multi-drug resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosa, because we have patients in our CF center as well as in other healthcare units that may have evidence of infection due to transmission within the healthcare setting. So we get back to some basic issues that I covered earlier today, but for everyone's benefit, I wanted to retrace a few steps to indicate the methods that we use for DNA typing or DNA profiling or molecular epidemiology. Pulse field gel electrophoresis, shown at the top of this slide, is the gold standard for DNA typing. It has been the oldest, most established method since the early 90s again. We go back to that period in the early 90s when so many new techniques were being developed and promulgated within the field. And Fred Tenover at the CDC and others certainly were able to develop methods that addressed the identification and typing of strains and in different pathogens. And you can see the DNA profiles here. I'm going to make a central point about pulse field because it's very important. Though it is a very robust method for strain identification, it's very cumbersome in the laboratory. And yes, I've done it myself, and maybe several of you have tried it. The problem is that we're using rare cutting restriction enzymes to basically try to isolate very large DNA fragments. It may not be so evident on this slide, but these are very large DNA fragments, thousands of bases in length. And the limitation is that you're stuck really with a pulse field, a pulsed electrical field, and large gels to separate these large DNA fragments. And we want to use a high-resolution, rapid approach to separate differently sized DNA fragments to do robust DNA typing, and then the informatics that follows. And so repetitive element-based PCR, RET-PCR, otherwise known as DiversaLab, provides the ability to amplify smaller DNA fragments separated by small interspersed repeats, and we can then generate profiles by microfluidics. And I'll get into that in a bit more detail. Finally, DNA sequencing is worth noting in this era when there has been such a tremendous revolution in the past 2 to 3 years in high-throughput DNA sequencing. We certainly may see it in the future in the clinical laboratory, but it's going to be a while before we know how to use DNA sequencing for typing. We simply do not have the ability right now to make meaningful interpretations of that really an excessive amount of information. So molecular typing of Pseudomonas aeruginosa has certainly very doable. These gram-negative organisms are very amenable to lysis DNA extraction, just like a variety of pathogens. There have been a number of studies that have been published to examine this problem of Pseudomonas aeruginosa infections in CF for a while. Different methods have been applied, mostly pulsed field gel electrophoresis and rapid methods, but no study has specifically focused on MRPA, or multidrug-resistant Pseudomonas. In two studies that were published, and you see the references here at the bottom, there was a dominant clone that was found to be responsible for the majority of these MRPA infections. So DNA typing may be very useful in this specific context. And so, again, one could think about any pathogen, right? This is an example. But we would certainly want to culture these isolates, get pure isolates that we can then use for DNA extraction. This, again, is very contingent on the intimate linkage between microbiology and molecular or molecular microbiology. The infection control unit outside of the laboratory may request testing, but some of these investigations may also be laboratory initiated. We extract nucleic acid, and we do it manually for this method because we've had the most reliable data set using the MoBio manual extraction platform. We then generate these RepPCR diversal lab profiles based on the fact that these little yellow arrows are separated by varying distances depending on the location of these interspersed conserved repetitive DNA elements, and at the end of the day, we get DNA products of different sizes. And I'm sorry if I'm boring some of you with molecular lingo, but it is important to think about how we generate these profiles, and I'll get into the specific application and data interpretation a little later. We can convert these peak profiles into virtual gels in the DiversaLab system. The real power is by examining this primary curve-based data to be able to distinguish strains. We're really pushing molecular diagnostics to the limit now. We're asking that thermal cycler to generate multiple fragments enough so that we can distinguish organisms beyond the species level, something that we simply cannot do reliably without a molecular method. And so it's worth it. It's worth the trouble, and we've been using it now for 5 years. Now, I know that things have changed, and many of us now are using VITEC 2 straight for susceptibility. Other labs are using manual methods for susceptibility testing for Pseudomonas. We could certainly document multi-drug resistance using a variety of approaches, but the point is that following culture and susceptibility testing, we then examine these strains, the multi-drug resistant strains of Pseudomonas, for their clonal relationships by DNA typing. And we're using DiversaLab for a wide variety of pathogens, not just MRPA, but this is one example that we've studied in depth. So we confirm, of course, the presence of MRPA. We then extract the DNA, and we do quantify nucleic acid using absorbance spectrophotometry. And this is repetitive element-based PCR. Again, some overlap with the earlier talk. This is the genome of Pseudomonas aeruginosa. The good news is that so many of these microbial or pathogen genomes have been sequenced and are available in the public databases now. And we now know that these repetitive DNA sequences are conserved and interspersed throughout all bacterial genomes, just like they are in mammalian genomes, right? They're just different classes of repetitive elements. And so different kits that include different DNA probes or primers are needed to be able to do reliable DNA typing with different organisms. But the principle is the same. We have primers that recognize these interspersed repetitive elements. They then amplify the DNA between these elements, the different size, and then we can separate the multiple DNA fragments in an electrical field to generate chromosomal DNA profiles. And now you can see schematically bacterial genome, RepPCR. This is really the old style in a gel. We now use microfluidics, a technology originally developed by Caliper Technologies here in California. And microfluidics simply means that we can move very tiny volumes of fluid through an electrical field to generate these profiles. These are DNA profiles, and each peak represents one of these DNA fragments. Okay, so think about this little piece of DNA that could be anywhere on the chromosome. We're not looking at one site or one gene, but we're looking throughout that genome. We then have one piece of DNA shown here by one peak in this curve profile. And then, of course, we can interpret the data based on a variety of considerations. some of which I went into earlier today. I'm not going to go in through the details of the troubleshooting this afternoon. So we have an advanced PCR-based DNA typing technology that we are using every week in our laboratory for modern infection control as well as for some reference typing work that we do. It's kit-based PCR that's optimized for different classes of pathogens, basically genus-dependent. There are some kits that will address the needs for larger classes of organisms such as yeasts and molds, mycobacteria, as well as non-fermentative gram-negative bacteria. The advantages of this system is that it's relatively time and cost-effective as DNA typing systems go. It's not quite as timely as real-time PCR detection of C. difficile, for example, but it does allow you now to track strains and do facile archiving using databases in the laboratory. So we can really apply bioinformatics in this case, and the software is built into the system. So there's a Pseudomonas typing kit. And we quality control, you know, these kits are all quality controlled, optimized, so we can do reliable typing using RepPCR DiversaLab. Again, just to reiterate, there's the microfluidics chip, and we can then analyze the data and examine these strain libraries, literally, with the software from DiversaLab. And we can then track organisms not only at a single point in time, but over time. We can see the distribution of specific strains within a hospital in a particular year. We can compare it to prior years, and we can focus on the strains that we know are present in a given location. We know that the strains that are maybe prevalent here in Los Angeles may be quite different to what we're seeing in Texas. So you've got this in the handout again just to illustrate the channels. It's fundamentally, it's electrophoresis, and there you have another example of a DNA profile. So these are the signatures, if you will, for each strain, and we can, again, depict them as a virtual gel, like bands, and we can now separate different strains and be able to track these. There's software that one can use that's web-based, and one can report the data in a variety of ways, and I'll show you some examples. So let's get back to the problem at hand. Pseudomonas aeruginosa, multidrug-resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosa, certainly can cause important respiratory tract infections that may be life-threatening and certainly may be very difficult to manage in children with cystic fibrosis. As you can imagine, one gets challenged by selection of the appropriate antimicrobial agents. So in collaboration, again, with Peter Hyatt and Jeff Stark, we've been tracking this over time, and you can see that using DiversaLab-based DNA typing, we've been able to identify a dominant clone present in our own hospital, in our own CF center here. This is that dominant clone. Now, you can see a couple of things. One is that over time, we've seen a gradual increase in the numbers of patients that are infected with this dominant clone of multidrug-resistant Pseudomonas. Again, there is no other way to determine this than using a DNA typing via molecular methods. The other key point is that we're seeing an increase in the number of clones that are prevalent. And so you can see gradually we've detected other clones that have infiltrated the unit carried by different children. We're only beginning to understand now the connection between these particular molecular profiles or strains and particular susceptibility profiles and possible differences in virulence and disease. Now, one can examine the data using a structured dendrogram. I showed a couple examples of that. But one can also take out that structure and just put the data as dots on a map. And that's a scatter plot. You see that word in the title. It may be new to some of you. A scatter plot simply refers to a non-hierarchical data representation, which we simply say, is this point similar to this one? If they are highly similar, they're close together, and if they're different, they're further apart. Okay? So we see here easily the presence of a single dominant clone. Each number here represents a single strain or isolate of multidrug-resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosa. And each of these dots or numbers, if you will, then indicates the relationship of these strains with one another. The level of similarity would be a better way of putting it. Now, once one begins to assemble large libraries it becomes very difficult to use a dendrogram or a structured format. So that this scatter plot that we can use within the DiversiLab software becomes very useful to examine large numbers of strains. And you can again see this as of July 2007, the presence of a dominant clone and a variety of outliers. And right here we see the emergence of a secondary clone. We can pick that up right away. And then we can basically link those numbers then to the DNA profiles, and we can do more sophisticated delving or mining into the data. Now, as of July 2007, just over a year ago, we had 62 total patients in the set. Again, these were just our cystic fibrosis kids with MRPA infections. 34 clones have been identified, but notice we have a dominant clone here in 21 patients. And what was really gratifying to us is that once we had identified that clone for a period of several months, we had effectively stopped the spread of this dominant clone, and no new patients had been clustered with that for several months. And that was really a new development for us. And I'll get back to that point in terms of how we tie it together. In other words, how the molecular data impacts patient management and ultimately the bottom line in terms of patient outcome. Here's the dominant clone. I want to show you some of the primary data here shown as a virtual gel just for ease of depiction here. You can clearly see the difference in this profile versus group 2 and group 3, all MRPA isolates. So again, in a different format than the scatter plot, one sees again the evidence of this dominant clone. You can see, when you look at it this way, you can do this for a restricted set of clones, and you can certainly pick out any subset, even if you have a large data set, if you want to examine it this way more closely. But the scatter plot gives you the ability to examine this in the context of large sets of strains. The February 2008 scatter plot shown here, again, we continue to see this dominant clone. That secondary clone basically never really materialized then with more recent data. You can see in July 2008 the persistence of this dominant clone. But what we effectively did in the past 18 months was we restricted the spread of that particular dominant clone by combining careful strain tracking with changes in patient management. One part of that, of course, is effective management by using the right antimicrobial agents. And now that our physicians are acquiring experience in managing infections with particular strains, they can also link treatment success to these individual strains. But we're still learning about that. That's still rather preliminary. As of July 2008, we have a minimum of 56 clones now observed when we added newly submitted samples during the past several months. You can see the time span now from October 2004 through April 2008 and now through July 2008. There have been 10 clusters of isolates identified that may represent 10 distinct clones. Notice that we're just hedging a little bit. But we definitely have a dominant clone, including 37 samples from 33 patients. We did have two patients that were infected with this dominant clone in the past several months. One patient had a previously typed isolate that was highly similar to this clone. And again, we think there's some strain evolution going on there. The second patient had not been typed previously. But the bottom line remained the same. When we examined the pattern of these infections and the trends, we had significantly slowed the trend of infection in the healthcare setting. Again, how does this get back to the practice in the hospital? Well, if we can stem the spread of these clones, and as we identify clones, we can couple more effective management by antibiotics in addition to more effective sequestration of these patients and isolation, et cetera. Basically, a more informed healthcare system then can handle these particular clones or strains more readily, limiting the spread, limiting the overall impact to children or adults in a different healthcare setting. And it may mean in the future that as we curtail hospital-acquired infections in this fashion, coupled with other strategies, we may then also not only improve the overall quality of patient care, but also really impact the bottom line for the healthcare institution. So we have a dominant clone that was the focus of our infection control efforts, and it may be that these dominant clones are more readily transmitted to different patients. That's an evolving concept in medical microbiology. There may be certain strains that are not necessarily more virulent. They may be as virulent, but they are more readily transmitted among different patients, similar to viral spread. You just have certain organisms that have a predilection to infecting a variety of individuals with different immune systems, okay? These children have been tracked. They've been treated promptly. The ones that have MRPA, we know how to deal with this infection now, although we have to be very cognizant of the challenge. They can be treated effectively now. Once we identify them as such, we can also place them in contact isolation by working with the families as well as the patients. We counsel the parents as well. So multiple interventions had to be implemented. As of July 2008, again, only two new patients identified with this clone in approximately 18 months, which was really quite a remarkable development for us, one that we're very happy with and our physicians are very happy with. So we are trying to control it as best we can. Again, combining molecular typing with solid microbiology practice and good infection control practice. That's modern infection control, the linkages. One more example of how we've applied DNA typing in the medical center as a whole. This is outside of Texas Children's. In combination with Robbie Darwish in our adult infectious disease group at the VA Medical Center, we applied the DiversiLab approach to identifying strains that may be linked to catheter-associated infections. So this group was also interested in doing studies with catheters impregnated with antimicrobial agents, but I won't get into the details of that. There's been much interest in that area, and the bottom line is how can antimicrobial-coated catheters be used to minimize biofilm-associated infections? But in this case, you see a variety of pathogens, Acinetobacter, you see Candida as well, Parapsilosis, Candida albicans, Staphylococcus epidermidis. You see the profiles. This is the catheter isolate, this is the blood isolate, and you can see virtual identity in multiple cases. And so we can potentially identify catheter-associated infections using molecular typing, and the data has been published with the reference at the bottom. So we're now well into 2008, approaching 2009. We have a variety of molecular methods at our disposal that need to be intimately coupled with good microbiology practice. We certainly want to continue to perform quality practice in the arena of blood cultures, and that was described earlier by Dr. Hall. We certainly want to continue to use our robust phenotypic approaches such as Gram stain and biochemical testing. And the next question then becomes, how do we apply or deploy molecular methods to advance the practice of microbiology in infectious diseases? We can use real-time PCR for rapid and accurate detection of specific pathogens, such as Clostridium difficile. I showed that earlier, and there are many other examples. But the problem is that this is very specific, too. So its glory is also its limitation. If we want to then sequence and identify any one of a number of different pathogens, we may need a more global approach. And so sequencing gives us a more global approach. But the limitation with sequencing is it stops basically at the level of species identification. And if we want to go further, we then need a global approach to DNA typing, such as DiversiLab, to be able to apply PCR, to be able to get profiles and distinguish these strains that we may generate from blood cultures, but we may also generate these cultures from other sources. So in summary, I just want to highlight a few things. The potential contributions in the context of hospital-acquired infections from molecular strategies. We have the ability today to perform enhanced surveillance and screening of a variety of pathogens, and we can use targeted approaches such as real-time PCR in the context of Clostridium difficile and Bordetella pertussis and a variety of other infections. We also have the ability to perform testing with increased accuracy, so we have fewer misidentifications or non-identifications, prompt and enhanced patient management, and I could be referring to the ability to identify strains more accurately with a VITEC 2 platform, refined biochemical testing, as well as molecular testing such as sequencing and typing. And that certainly may impact our bottom line, too, in terms of coding. And finally, by having the ability to successfully apply molecular methods to track individual strains, we now have the ability to identify these nosocomial infections more rapidly, more accurately, to potentially distinguish these organisms from community-acquired organisms, and ultimately, hopefully, minimize the impact of these hospital-acquired infections on our patients. This is where the real credit goes, as you know. I can stand up here and talk forever, but the bottom line is the people in the laboratory, all of us, have to participate as a team. And I've already highlighted the interdepartmental, inter-team relationships within the hospitals with our infection control group and with our pediatricians. But I also want to highlight Renee Webb, who manages our molecular unit and is very actively engaged in this modern infection control practice that I've described today. She works very closely with our microbiology team, and Ruth Ann Luna, who's done so much of the work in terms of developing these assays and implementing them in the laboratory as well, and a number of other medical technologists that have been intimately involved in this practice for the past several years. Thank you very much.